This is the Shogun Podcast on TV Podcast Industries, and we're talking about Shogun Chapter 8, The Abyss of Life.
I must say I am impressed. You have made your own way out here.
Thank you, Father. Ah, Koyoi wa asu ni shite kurasabe. Except I seem to find Catholics in every sordid corner of this country. Like the cockroach.
It was not you I came to Edo for. I have urgent business with Toranaga-sama. Strange that you are living out here. Typically a Hatamoto is given residence within the confines of his lord's castle. What are your plans? Now he has cut you loose.
Well, to start, I will reunite with my crew. Get back aboard my vessel. Then pay a visit to that black ship I have heard so much about.
Welcome back, fellow warriors, to the Shogun Podcast on TV Podcast Industries. We are discussing all things around Shogun Chapter 8, The Abyss of Life. I am one of your hosts, John.
I'm your other host, Derek. Welcome back.
Yes. What a title. Love it.
Oh, what
the Abyss of Life.
Yeah, absolutely. I think
really
when,
good.
Yeah, when this whole thing starts, you kind of see how much toll the death of Nagakado has taken on everybody, really.
Yeah.
The stars. So, it gets worse from there, really, for the episode, doesn't it?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. This, to me, was just an amazing, amazing episode. Mm-hmm. Absolutely loved it. Shocking, sort of manipulating. It's just really, really good. Nice, weirdly, a great little bit of humor, at least for me, at one point, to do with the courtesans and the church.
Of course, yes, that's a great one. Great.
Really good. But I think before we get into our spoiler-filled discussion around Chapter 8 of Shogun, first, a quick reminder to join us over at tvpodcastindustries.com, where you can subscribe to any good or evil podcast catcher of your choice. You can send in your thoughts, theories, observations, comments about all things Shogun-y to feedback at tvpodcastindustries.com, or join us over on our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/TV Podcast Industries, where you can leave your thoughts, theories, and comments on our spoiler-filled posts.
Absolutely. If you haven't read the book, I want to know, did you expect all the twists and turns that have been happening throughout Shogun this season? Because I certainly didn't. There's lots of things that are happening that I'm going, I would never have written that, never would have thought this is the way it's going to go. So I'm excited to hear your thoughts about that. It'd be great to hear them before the end of the season. Only two more episodes to go after this one. So how is it going to work out?
Well, absolutely. It seems as though things are probably falling into place for Toranaga.
Yeah.
But at great cost, obviously.
Absolutely.
But up first, fellow warriors, we just want to give a quick call out for a review from James Jazzy over on Apple Podcasts. They say, favorite Shogun podcast. James Jazzy says, I've listened to almost all the Shogun podcasts, and this one is my favorite, along with the official podcast from the show. The summary and analysis is concise and insightful. The hosts are smart, articulate, and have a pleasant manner. Keep up the good work. Excellent. Thank you so much, James Jazzy, for that review. Love
Absolutely.
Getting in the reviews.
Yeah.
It does help for people to find us and also to spread the word of the podcast. Because as we always say, sharing the podcast is, of course, sharing the love.
Yes, it is. Absolutely. Thanks so much, James. It's really good of you to send in your thoughts on the podcast. And as John says, great to leave a review for us over there. If anybody else wants to leave us a review, please do so. You can find the Shogun on TV Podcast Industries podcast on any of your favorite feeds, or leave a review, of course, on the TV Podcast Industries main feed, where we're also covering Invincible and Star Wars The Bad Batch weekly at the moment. Just finished Invincible this week, but still got a bit more to go of Star Wars The Bad Batch, and of course Shogun a couple more weeks to go of that as well. So Love to have you join us over there as well.
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But with that, Derek, please tell us who gave us what, when, where, how, and why.
Well, the show, of course, is based on James Clavell's 1975 novel of the same name, Shogun. The head writers of the show are Rachel Kondo and Justin Marks. This episode was written by Shannon Goss, who also wrote episode 3. And this episode was directed by Emmanuel Ossel-Kafour, who also directed an episode of Mike Flanagan's Midnight Club. Oh, and okay. Will direct an episode of the fifth and final season of Star Trek Discovery, which came out last week. The first couple of episodes came out last week. So that's kind of cool
good stuff.
Yeah, having Shogun on one channel and having Star Trek Discovery, something completely far distant in the future, on another channel. How cool is that?
Yeah, and having Mike Flanagan's Midnight Club, of course, mm-hmm. homage to The Breakfast Club.
Kind of, yes.
I absolutely loved The Midnight Club. It was great.
But it was really good.
I also like most of Mike Flanagan's stuff.
Yeah, pretty much everything. It was the only show that was intended to have two seasons. And of course, as these things happen, when you intend to have two seasons of something, they don't confirm for a second season. So.
No, exactly.
But it was very good, though. So those are the writers and director, John. Do you want to tell us what they gave us with your synopsis for this episode of Shogun, Chapter 8, The Abyss of Life?
Sure. Toranaga's defeated clan moves to Edo to mourn the death of his son for the traditional 49 days. As Toranaga and his trusted generals await their fate, John Blackthorn must decide who he fights for, the lord who has turned his back on him, or the ambition that brought him to Japan in the first place.
Ooh, very good. Very good. And does he make his decision at the end, or has he also been manipulated by Lord Toranaga?
I think everyone has been manipulated by Lord Toranaga by the looks of it.
Potentially. Or maybe I just misframed that question. Maybe Lord Toranaga is just someone that really knows people and what way they are going to act when put into a circumstance or a situation.
Well, that's it. I think it's a bit column A, a bit column B, because, yeah, he gets Mariko to go and travel with John Blackthorn to Osaka and, of course, with Yabushige as well.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it is column A, column B. He absolutely has strategy and tactics, but he is also a huge opportunist.
Certainly is.
And uses events to his advantage, but knows the long game and the past and the connections. So
absolutely.
Just a good all-rounder, I think you would say.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
But let us get into our top Bushidos for this episode. Bushido number one, 49 days of mourning in Edo.
Yeah, this is the aftermath, of course, of the death of Nagakado, the son of Toranaga, as they bring his body to their hometown of Edo. And I think I kind of missed it when I was watching the episode the first time, but it's his half-brother's army that are waiting on the borders of Edo for Toranaga and his own army, his own people, to mourn the loss of his son. So they stop at the borders. This is what Mariko explains to John Blackthorn just before they cross into the city. And everybody's dealing with the mourning in a different way. Toranaga, we hear him coughing and spluttering as he's coming into Edo, and then he disappears from sight. We see some very different reactions from some of his vassals. Some of them, even though they're in mourning for Toranaga's son, are wearing their armor as a form of protest for the fact that Toranaga is now going to give himself up to
surrender to Shido. They do not like that decision.
Exactly.
And so, but we also see that whilst Toranaga has gone back to Edo to mourn, he doesn't make his own son's cremation. But seemingly because of the onset of this cough that he has picked up from the ride.
Yeah.
But I think what frames this really nicely is the brief return to Osaka, where we hear that the word of Toranaga's surrender has reached Ishido and Lady Achiba. Because in a sense, Ishido is kind of smirking, happy. It's almost like, okay, there's the fait accompli, that's it's going to be that bloodless.
He's celebrating his victory there.
Whereas Lady Achiba is like, until you know his face is pressed to the floor in sort of supplication to myself in surrender, I don't trust it.
Yes.
And I think, you know, that is ultimately the setup for really how this progresses through this episode mm-hmm. with that final moment as well, which we'll get to in its own Bushido point.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's just a really, really good setup for this morning because, you know, in effect here, there's extra time afforded to Torunaga with this traditional 49 days of mourning, which mm-hmm. has to be respected.
Yeah.
It allows him to get back to his seat and base of power yeah. in Edo. In a sense, maybe you would think it's so that he can do regroup all his forces and an all out kind of frontal assault mm. or of some description. So it's really interesting how this goes, but ultimately this is all about the death of Nagakata as well, yeah. you know, with the cremation
yeah.
and the different mourning that's happening.
Exactly. And it's interesting that you mention respect and you mention the idea that he could be gathering his forces here, because while Torunaga isn't really seen very much at the beginning of this episode, we see a lot of his other vassals. And I think there's a really, really interesting scene as all the vassals are sitting around. It's almost like a wake that they're having
yeah.
for Nagakado. And interestingly, everybody is criticizing Nagakado, even Hiramatsu, who's the closest to a member of family that Torunaga has had. And even he is saying he's a silly boy. He died exactly as he lived, going into situations way too fast. And it's only Oni, who's a more recent friend of him, who stands up and says, he would love to have seen us here celebrating him. He would love to have seen yeah. us here drinking to his memory and saying, you know, while he may have been rash in his actions, at least he stood up for something that he believes in. And while it may have ended badly, at least he stood up for our country, stood up for Japan. So this is kind of sowing the seeds. The rest of the vassals all take that on board, as a lot of things that Oni says, they do take on board.
Well, he speaks a lot of sense.
Yeah.
You know, I love this wake. I mean, I mm-hmm. do think that they were there honoring Nagakata in
yes,
their own
were.
Way.
Yeah.
Just Torunaga was absent from that yeah. as well. That they talk about him being brave mm. and that, you know, his stories, he loved listening to stories
yes.
and his stories that would just continue and continue and continue. Mm-hmm. And as you say, it is Hiramatsu that says, but he was reckless in what he did. And
yeah.
now we find ourselves in this predicament. And that's the thing. I really like Omi here and mm-hmm. standing up essentially, for his friend.
Yeah.
You know, his kind of ally, in a sense. You could almost see that if Nagakata had survived all this, had inherited Torunaga's fiefdom and so on, that mm-hmm. similarly it would be the partnership between them, those two, like with Torunaga and Yabushige in that sense, you know?
I know what you mean, but actually I think it would be even closer, an even closer relationship. I think it might be closer to the way Torunaga and Hiramatsu worked together
yeah,
and
no,
have
you're
been working together for
yeah,
decades,
absolutely. Yeah. You know, and like he says, as you say, it gets all the, you know, of Torunaga's generals as well as Hiramatsu and Buntaro. Mm-hmm. So their ears prick up. You know, he said, he's not here. You know, it's sad that his friend is dead. He would have, as you say, he would have loved us sharing these stories about him, but he's not here because of his lord surrendering.
Yes. Yeah.
And so it's immediately the onus is back on Torunaga there.
Yeah.
And you see the look, as you say, in the eyes, and it is kind of taken on board here. So it's really, mm-hmm. really interesting.
Absolutely.
You know?
And also as they travel to the cremation of Nagakado, there's the conversation between Hiramatsu and Yabushige, who's kind of going, we should get our forces together. We should bring the cannons and guns together and go and have our assault on Osaka, have that crimson sky that we talked about. And I kind of like the twist in that here, where Hiramatsu goes, actually, one of the conditions of our surrender is that you do bring the guns and cannons back to Osaka as a gift to our new lord upon our surrender.
Yeah.
So,
and he is also a condition of the surrender.
Mm-hmm.
Ishido knows that he effectively, you know, in a sense, can't be trusted mm-hmm. here,
yeah.
Or possibly is still on the cusp of being turned, because mm-hmm. We certainly, you know, later on we see him with John Blackthorne, yep, sort of debating about what it is he might do or what he might do with the time that he's got in Osaka, mm-hmm, away from the eyes of Torunaga, you know, or the many eyes of Torunaga.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no, I like that as well. It's also the fact that in this moment of mourning, you know, in these discussions that they have with their lord, who's still coughing, looks, mm-hmm, much weaker.
Yeah.
You see Hiramatsu, you have Mirako, and you have Father Martin, the Jesuit priest.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's trying to get a sense of what the talk is in Osaka.
Mm-hmm.
Again, there's this end game here. Torunaga blatantly saying to Father Martin, no, you go back from here and you say exactly bit by bit what you have seen here.
Mm.
And then you get your church in Edo. You know, I will give you that land, mm-hmm, as the reward for doing that. If you do this one thing, I should say, for me.
Yeah.
Because again, I just feel Torunaga, the opportunistic bit is he understands and learns that Father Martin is here on his own volition,
mm-hmm,
not being sent by the head of the church in Japan.
Yeah.
So, you know, he can see that agency there and wants to exploit it.
Yeah.
So I love that. And of course, coming out of that, Hiramatsu is like, we are fighting. You know, there, mm-hmm, is a plan here.
Yes.
He almost reinvigorates the generals again, and
exactly,
Omi and Yabushige, as that, you know, this is part of a plan. We, yeah, are going to fight.
Exactly, because he's basically thinking there's no way that Torunaga would be showing off his weakness to Osaka. There must be a plan here. Show them that you're weak and then show them real strength,
yeah,
kind of thing. There is a great moment in that conversation with Father Martin, who generally speaks in Japanese to Torunaga, has been allowed to in the past, has worked with Mariko, of course, and has translated John Blackthorne in the past. Here he's told, because the church is not an ally to Torunaga, he's not even allowed to use their Japanese language anymore. He must speak in English and allow Mariko to translate so that his words aren't hidden at all. Thought that was really a really good line being drawn in the sand between,
absolutely,
the church and, yeah, Torunaga's version of Japan.
Well, and, yeah, it's interesting that, you know, with that discussion with Hiramatsu and Mariko, is, you know, the discussion is around whether they can actually strangle Ishibo's ambition,
mm-hmm,
whether there is a way in, you know, a gap in Lady Achiba's defenses,
right, yeah,
and that they can align with her in, mm, order to stifle and strangle Ishido's ambition and power effectively.
Yeah.
So I kind of like that, and ultimately, yeah, it's kind of assumed that there is no way in here.
Yeah, because Mariko goes to meet with Lady Rin, who's just given birth to Torunaga's granddaughter.
Yeah.
And Lady Rin is the sister of Ishida, and Mariko is going to ask her, you know, how's your sister feeling at the moment? Is, you know, what's the communication method that you're using? And it's like, well, she's sent over her congratulations, but that's kind of it. There's no more there. You know what she's like. So no way in there through the sister, effectively. So they've kind of exhausted all options. They've said Mariko had a relationship with her when they were younger, but doesn't know her very well. Lady Rin, her sister, does still know her, of course, but there's no influence that Lady Rin would have on Ishida. So that's shut down. That kind of option that they may have,
yeah,
is shut down there. And the one other thing that you mentioned there, Father Martin is told that he's allowed to build his church in Edo on behalf of the Jesuit order. And then we have the other reward. Lady Jin is going to get her tea house district also in, yeah, Edo.
Next to the church's plot,
of
which,
course,
I loved. I, yeah, must say, I just love that little sort of disruptive sense of humor there, mm-hmm, in sort of 16th century Japan. So I really like that.
Yeah.
You see kind of Father Martin sort of going,
yeah,
you know, his courtesans.
Courtesans are going to be across the way, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think the other thing about that is having Lady Jin and Kiku surveying their plot in Edo, sort of realizing, sort of imagining their dream of this quarter of Edo that's dedicated to the courtesans.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's Omi and Kiku having that conversation about his loyalty and, you know, and her loyalty to Jin. And he's reflecting that and mirroring it with his loyalty to, I think, to his uncle, actually, or it might be to Lord Taranaga. But in effect, he's saying to Kiku, is there a moment when loyalty becomes a disservice or a harm? You know, he sees his favorite courtesan's loyalty to Lady Jin, and he's there going, but you've brought this about because of your talent.
Yeah.
You know, do you see that there is a moment where that loyalty is a disservice or a harm, effectively to yourself? And she's like, no.
Yeah.
And he's asking that in relation, I think it's about Taranaga, but I have in my notes that it's doubts about his uncle. So I can't quite remember, but it could be both. It could be either of those because we've had that moment where John Blackthorne has been sort of making propositions to his uncle Yabushige.
That's true. Yeah, I did take it as a reflection of his thoughts about Toranaga. Again, he's just lost his friend who stood up for something he believed in, as he said. So I take it that he's kind of going, well, everybody's blindly following Toranaga's lead here, and he sees Kiku following Jin's lead here and just being still a courtesan in her court, even though she may get her own tea house in the district because of her talents. It still will all be owned by Lady Jin. So I think he's kind of going, hang on a second, why are you still loyal to her the way I'm loyal to Toranaga? Is there a point here where I should cut my ties and cut my loyalty? Because I think that's a lot of this episode is about that loyalty to Toranaga.
Well, I think it equally works for both, given the conversation beforehand. So, yeah, but it's, I must say he is my favorite kind of smaller part character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see that.
Because I just find the scenes that Omi has are just at real points of influence.
Yes.
So it feels like, even though, yes, he's not a general, he's just a nephew to his uncle.
Absolutely.
He's the head of a small wet fishing village.
Absolutely.
You know, he's actually become quite influential.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that was through sort of his conversations and manipulation of Taranaga's son.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's quite an interesting character.
Absolutely.
But I think it's time to move on to our Bushido point number two.
Mm.
Yes. Crew reunited.
Yeah.
Smelly sailors.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's hard to remember exactly what John's motivation has been throughout the show. John Blackthorne's motivation has been throughout the show. He arrived at the beginning of the season on Japan with a mission. He was to go in, find the trade routes, take out the Portuguese, and begin new trade routes for the Dutch and potentially for the English. He had his mission getting into Japan. He lost his crew. He lost his ship at the beginning of the season. And his motivation for the whole season here was to get back to his crew, potentially get his ship back, and then maybe carry out the rest of his mission, or maybe just sail back to England. And so those were the options that we had there. So finally, he is told when he gets to Edo, his crew have actually been taken here. This is where his crew have been resting their heads for the last while. Taranaga never said that to him. Taranaga never gave him the information that his crew had been taken to a safe place in Edo. Yeah? So I thought that was kind of interesting, firstly, because he's just told it as he crosses the border into the city. He's told his crew are there for him. He's also released from his service.
Yeah.
He is no longer in service to Taranaga, no longer has to do anything for him.
He's a free agent.
He's a completely free agent, and he's given the journals that could have proved him a criminal and could have led to his death. They've been handed back to him by Mariko. So he starts to set up his own household in Edo. He still has his household, which is also mentioned, that his household is still being run back in the fishing village of Ajiro. So whenever he does return there, if he does, those lands, title and monies are all still available to him. Fuji's taking care of all of that for him. But there is a moment when he bumps into Father Martin. I just think it's a good setup point for what happens later when he meets up with his crew, because not only is John speaking really good Japanese to some of the people in Edo, when he bumps into Father Martin, he's wearing the full outfit of a Japanese person rather than any Western clothes at all. So Martin comments on this to him, kind of going, you're going to wear those things when you go and meet your crew because they're going to think you've changed and you've been manipulated by the Japanese. He also tries to correct John's Japanese as well. John's looking for charcoal, which burns brighter and will make
and
his
hotter.
And hotter and will make his new home much better. And Father Martin thinks he's just looking for more wood. So I like that because it's a real challenge to John. Hang on a second. The last time I saw you, you were on your knees in front of Taranaga. Here you are with a title like Hatamoto, coming into the city, wearing Japanese clothes, speaking Japanese.
Smelling fresh,
exactly. So it's a good setup. John wants nothing to do with Father Martin. Father Martin's like the exact personification of what he hates most, which is the church and their hold they have on Japan at the moment, and that's developed over time. So I thought that was really interesting to have the conversation between the two of them.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think it's really good because I like how it gets John Blackthorne to almost question how he's going to reconnect with his crew. And I mean, ultimately, you know, he doesn't get that warm reception because he is there with his Japanese clothes on. John Blackthorne is actually a bit repulsed by the smell and the stench of one of the Dutch crewmen, probably as much from alcohol as well as everything else. But, you know,
But really, really important to point out that, just so everybody remembers, right back at the start of the season, he was asked to bathe.
Yes,
and he said no. You know, do you want me to die from catching diseases from bathing too often, was his idea in his head.
Yeah, exactly.
And here he is walking into an area that has alcohol, has his former crewmates that he would have known so well, and he's holding his nose at the disgusting smells that he's smelling. So,
but it comes back to that whole thing where, you know, they had given up John Blackthorne for dead, and so, you know, they question what his purpose was, what the purpose of this voyage was. You know, really, you know, that they could have turned around before the Magellan Straits. Did they have to go past the, you know, what was this? Because like you say, he has a number of different roles here. Yes, he was the pilot of the ship. Yes, it was about Dutch trade routes, but it was also about breaking the monopoly of the Spanish and Portuguese trade routes.
Absolutely.
Because at the time, you had the Dutch fighting the Spanish as well to be free of Spanish rule, with England being an ally.
Yes.
So it was about a bigger geopolitical sphere as well. So, you know, again, they're his journals. So you don't, you know, that suspicion from the Dutch crew about, well, you know, and now you're here dressed in refined Japanese garments.
Absolutely.
You haven't just been left to rot or to do your own thing, even though he is also being prevented from leaving like they are.
Yeah.
It's that he has at least been given a title, a salary effectively, and lands and a house.
Absolutely.
So they haven't. So then it's that suspicion just immediately falls on him from this crew member. Yeah, ends in a fight.
It does. And the other thing he questions is the ambition of John Blackthorne. It's not only that they could have turned around at some point and it wouldn't have been too bad a thing when they arrived on shore, at least they got home safe and alive. They're also questioning whether John Blackthorne did this just to be the first Englishman to cross the Magellan Strait. That ambition that's within John, that he wants to be the brave adventurer traveling the world, setting records, which is part of the reason why the crewman's looking at him going, you know, is that what you've done here? You know, that ambition that you had to be the first to cross the Magellan Strait, is that the reason why you, an Englishman, are standing in front of me, having learnt Japanese, wearing Japanese clothes, having all your titles and finery? Have you just gone the ambitious route to make those connections and sort yourself out, basically, and not the rest of us? Which is interesting as well.
Yeah. So it's kind of less friends reunited.
And more friends who fight it.
Yeah,
I guess.
Exactly.
Yes. Yeah, so that's the end, I guess, of the crew and John Blackthorne, because it doesn't look like he's going to be going back to them anytime soon. And it doesn't look like they're going to be very interested in dealing with him. He tries to say to them that he could have a full crew that he's worked with in Japan, bring them along, put them on their ship when they get that back, and then they can make for the horizon. But that doesn't seem what these guys want, or this guy wants, as the representative of the crew.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But let us get on to Bushido number 3.
Mm.
Buntaro doesn't spill the tea, but Mariko does.
I'm sorry, John. That's my fault.
I know it is.
I couldn't think of anything better. It's a great scene.
Obviously. It's
a great
really
scene.
Good.
And really, in a way, we've talked quite a bit about the relationship between Buntaro and Mariko. We'll mention it again in our feedback, because we've been continually getting feedback in since one of our pieces of feedback mentioned Justin Marks, the showrunner, saying that Buntaro is truly in love with Mariko, and we were all, as viewers watching the show, going, but he's never shown that he's in love with her. He seems to despise her. He seems to hate her. He seems to want to keep her alive when she wants to die, that kind of thing. And I think this might be the scene that Justin Marks is talking about.
Yeah.
I think it is revealed here that Buntaro, in his mind, feels like he does love Mariko.
He has feelings for her. Mm. I mean, I think just the whole act of the tea ceremony,
mm-hmm.
Being sort of so born out of a respect,
mm-hmm.
and a care and attention. I mean, in some ways, it almost shows a bit of that he has to show it through the tea ceremony,
yes.
rather than through his direct emotions and affections to her.
Yeah.
But Mariko ultimately does accept this, you know, and it feels like, you know, Buntaro is a really difficult character,
mm-hmm.
In terms of this relationship with Mariko, because, you know, it's kind of coming from a place of misogyny, which was, I guess, commonplace in those days, a man being better than women.
Mm.
Oh, that's how I see it. Yeah. That might just be a pure Western
approach.
I think
that's just Buntaro. Well.
No, but yeah. I mean, you also then, even Toranaga, who understands the qualities that
mm-hmm.
Women can have, it's for his purpose, mm-hmm. you know, or he still pulls the card of, it's more he pulls the card of I am your lord rather than I am a man. But you know, it's like it's still a patriarchal society.
Oh, 100%, 100%. I'm sure it is. But Buntaro in himself, just taken on his own, has not shown any love for Mariko throughout the season that we've seen on screen. Here he's using a ceremonial moment to show her that he loves her. And he's telling her, I'm trying to bring us back to those young days where we were once together at the beginning of a relationship where we were in love. And Mariko says, I don't remember those days. And when you hear it the first time, the way that she poses it to him, the way she says it to him, it sounds like, I just don't have a memory of that. She is saying to him, there were no days like that I loved you. There may have been days that you loved me back then, but there were no days that I loved you. And I wonder if it's partly that's what happened. We didn't see their early years. We only saw that moment when he saw her, and then she was proposed to marriage, and we knew that she wasn't happy with the arranged marriage that was going on between the two families, effectively, with her at the center of it. But it seems like maybe Buntaro was in love with her until she continually asked to end her life. And then he realized that she has no love for him, and now thinks, by doing this before they die, because he believes now Toranaga is going to lose here and they are all going to die, if he does this reconciliation between the two of them, then both of them can die honorably, is what he says, as a protest against Toranaga. They both die together.
Yeah.
And they can send a message to everybody else that they don't believe in Toranaga. And I think that adds to how vitriolic the response from Mariko is. And it is. It's like a dagger straight into his heart as she says to him, you still don't understand. The reason why I wanted to die was to get away from you. If I have to die with you, I'd rather live 1,000 more years. Like, that is brutal.
It is really brutal.
Yeah, coming from a person he's effectively declaring his love again for.
Exactly. This is what I mean by a really difficult character with mm-hmm. Buntaro, because in that moment, you're really conflicted because you're going, wow, that is harsh. Mm-hmm. That is the biggest burn. I mean, that's like proposing and, you know, being basically told no.
Yeah.
But it's even more than that because
it's like having the engagement ring thrown back in your face or into the sea so you can't retrieve it and get the money back.
Everything around it is so poetic. I mean, even the tea ceremony, in its own way, it's so intimate and kind way of doing it, but it is divorced from physical intimacy and in a sense, emotional intimacy. It's almost like it's done with the, you know, the three-level hearth or the eightfold fence.
Yeah.
It's almost that way of having to express it.
It is actually, it's interesting you say that because he does say to her at the end of the ceremony, she compliments him on his style of doing the ceremony as well as he did. And he says to her, only for you, as in, I'm only doing it this brilliantly because I love you. And I do feel that moment is where she breaks open her eightfold fence, as we talked about back in that episode, when she explains her most hidden, deep thoughts, the ones that could get you killed if you share them with anybody. She shares them straight to Buntara's face and tells him, I don't love you. I'd rather live forever than die with you.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that knockback. And in a sense, you kind of, on the one hand, you're going, you know, totally justified from Mariko to say this.
Yeah, absolutely.
You're offering me death now, even, let alone the reasons for it.
Yeah.
But equally, you kind of go, oh, wow. And I guess ultimately by the end of the episode, given what happens as well, you go, okay, Buntaro had a bad return to Edo.
Yeah,
let's put it that way.
Yes, he did. Absolutely. But I did think it was an absolutely wonderful scene. It's just...
It's superb.
It's the quiet power of Mariko after the quiet ceremony of the tea.
And I think that's it. It's the observation of the tea ceremony. It's that observation of how they react to one another. It reminded me of, you know, the veneered cups with gin, with Mariko, with Fuji, and the moment of Kiku, John Blackthorne. Again, it's just wonderfully observed. Really, really pitch perfect in how it's done. And as I say, I mean, it's actually pure poetry. Just the writing is so lovely. I think there's no other word I can say about it. I mean, even in the harshness, just the way, you know, it's returned to Buntaro, there's a great sort of sense to it of just power.
Mariko spitting the tea.
Exactly. It's effectively the same thing. So really, really good scene, I think, for these two, and it just adds to this really unfortunate relationship, in a sense.
Absolutely.
But should we get on to Bushido number 4? Because things only get worse for old poor Buntaro. I mean, I have to say, despite everything, I'm kind of like going, that's not a great few days in Edo.
Absolutely.
As we have probably one of the more shocking parts of the series, let alone this episode, with Hiramatsu's sacrifice.
Oh, this is just incredible as a scene, as it's all staged, as you see, you know, what looks like a sickly Toranaga getting together all of his vassals, getting really aggressively angry about the fact that he's heard that some of them wore their armor at his son's funeral in protest, and saying they are still dedicated to him, and he has made the decision here. They must follow what he tells them to do. They must surrender. You know, going against what Hiramatsu had said earlier on. Yeah. Hiramatsu thinking that that he was actually just setting up for a battle, and here he has them all lining up. He's got a document written up for them all to sign, agreeing that they will stay in line with Toranaga. They will
surrender
all of them. And you see, as it goes down the line, you see the faces of some of the vassals kind of going, but is this still part of the plan? Is this, you know, is there going to be a big twist here themselves? And as a viewer, absolutely, you're watching it going, where's the twist here? Toranaga is getting so aggressively forceful with these guys. You see the first two guys sign it, and then they start to step back away from it. They start to say they won't sign it.
Well, that's a challenged by his generals, who effectively say, we are here to advise you not to just blindly follow orders. You know, this is, in a sense, his own council of regents, really, within the clan. You know, his view is that this goes beyond his clan, and that the preservation of their clan, this is about the preservation of Japan.
Exactly.
This is a more sort of holistic sort of national view of the best thing for Japan, not his clan. And I think, you know, it comes across as a surprise to Hiramatsu as well. And so Hiramatsu's challenge ultimately is the dead end, the cul-de-sac challenge here of challenging the ultimate clan power here of Torinaga, which is, you know, if you don't change your mind, I will commit seppuku, you know? And this is then this kind of standoff between these two, you know, his trusted friend, his influential advisor, his partner in crime in a lot of cases, you know, with Hiramatsu. And
well, I suppose last week, seeing the flashback to the two of them side by side when Torinaga was only, what, 13, wasn't it, on his first battle? And it was Hiramatsu that was standing by his side back then, from his first battle to his last here. Hiramatsu, what seems like totally unbelieving that his lord would stop here, would give up and would surrender. And it's just, it gets so stressful and gets so emotional when the two of them are battling back and forth between each other, and it's Torinaga saying to him, well, then I guess we can't see any future, time for seppuku, right? You know, I guess we can't see an impasse here. Now you must kill yourself, because that's what you said you'd do. And it's, you can almost feel Hiramatsu pushing back against him, but then sticking by his guns, taking his sword, making Buntaro be his second, cutting himself open, and Buntaro taking his head, and the head rolling across the floor to the feet of Torinaga in front of the rest of his generals, the rest of his vassal.
That's brutal. As you say, it's just really tense, and it's hugely charged, hugely emotional. It's even just, you know, the responses of like Omi and Yabushige in Lord Torinaga's palace, you know, it's them. They're kind of like, is this for real? Is this really happening? I love the fact that Hiramatsu says, you know, then this is farewell. And I mean, with Buntaro, as I say, you know, what a few days for Buntaro, because he's asked to be the second to effectively decapitate his father. But also, he wants to follow his father into death, and his father refuses him quote, so he knows how it feels to be denied, which feels like it's telling him, well, this is what you've been doing to Mariko for all these years. And this is the point where you kind of go, is this just the ultimate sacrifice? And I believe it is. I believe that this is part of Taranaga's plan, because he says that you must not give up on your lord, i.e. Torinaga. Yes. You are to trust in him. And also because you see the effect of what's happened on Torinaga with Mariko, where again, she's slaying on the poetry, on the haiku front afterwards.
Yeah.
But, you know, he talks about his friend, his good friend. So it feels like this is, in some ways, part of the plan. I might be totally wrong, but it just feels like that.
I don't think you're wrong. I think that's why it's such a shocking revelation when we have Torinaga talking to Mariko, because not only is he talking about his friend, he's saying that Hiramatsu played his part. It seems to me anyway, Torinaga's saying this was the plan we came up with. It was either everybody dies, or we convince everybody that I'm going to surrender. And in order to do that, I had to sacrifice Hiramatsu, and he was willing to make that
and
sacrifice.
That I'm at my weakest, because you see that it's he's lost his son. He's effectively just lost his right-hand advisor. you have him coughing, spluttering, looking a lot frailer over the course of this. You have his conversation with Father Martin to say, you know, tell them exactly what you saw here. And it's interesting because when Toranaga goes to his son's ashes, you know, he goes, thank you, my son. You earned me some extra time. I will not waste it for you and Hiramatsu. I will not waste it. You know, and that's what I mean. It's a plan born out on the hoof of the opportunity that his son, even though he thought he might do that, he didn't necessarily know he would die. But he games everything and is opportunistic and has a following that is absolutely loyal to the cause in what Hiramatsu does. And it's just kind of like, that's also, it's not just the shock of Hiramatsu, but it's just that scope of scenario gaming that Toranaga is doing here. You know, which is just like kind of so fantastic. It's unbelievable.
Massively shocking. Massively shocking. But these scenes all end, as we say, when we get the reveal that this was the plan, as he talks to Mariko and says to her, now it's time, are you ready to play your part? He'd set her up and established this with Mariko, that the reason she was almost hiding in plain sight in the Todo clan as married to Buntaro was because her father had left something for her to do, a legacy for her to complete for their family. When it comes to that point, she will be brought in, which is what Toranaga's doing here. He's telling her, you need to go to Asakane. This is your play. So that will be interesting to see what happens there. And we also get, when we kind of mentioned it earlier on a little bit, but we also get that John has aligned himself to Yabushige. Yabushige has now accepted John coming on board because he does think Toranaga's gone a bit crazy. So he has to get himself out of there, get himself to Osaka. John is now being brought on board to
but I like how he discusses that with Mariko, in that he kind of says, have Yabushige and the Anjin, have they aligned yet? They're like goshawks, short wings, you know, could only see so far in front of them, have only the notion of flying short distances, not the long game. And, you know, and then chucks her into going to Osaka as part of a plan of what he believes she can do for him in Osaka and can execute it. But also it's disruptive for John Blackthorne, the fact that she is there. And you see it on their faces when she comes aboard the ship taking them to Osaka late at night, you know, unexpectedly, and you can sense the disruption that she's just introduced on board that ship, not only with John Blackthorne, but with the Yabushige.
Yes, absolutely. Although there's an interesting thing that I noticed watching this episode through a couple of times. I'd mentioned before that John is starting to learn Japanese. It's quite good. It's not great, but it's quite good. But it is quite interesting that I wonder whether John has just been learning phrases that he needs in certain situations to make it seem like he's getting on better in Japan than he is. You know, he easily is able to go up to Lord Toranaga and tell him that he mourns the loss of his son, which would be a phrase that would be something that maybe you would learn to say something. He may have specifically asked Mariko, how can I say this phrase, and then said it over and over in his head and gone to Lord Toranaga. But there's a moment with Yabushige and John on their own on the ship when Yabushige comes to him and says, that thing you said the other day, I really appreciated it, something like that, roughly. And John looks at him completely blankly. And it's a very, that would seem like a much more simple phrase. If you're learning a new language, you would learn relatively simple phrases like, that was a good thing you said, you know? So it's like as if Mariko didn't come aboard, John and Yabushige would be going all the way back to not being able to understand each other like they weren't able to understand each other at the beginning of the series, you know? So Mariko being aboard, at least she can help translate between the two of them as well. So thought that was interesting. And also, speaking of that, you know, John being aligned to Yabushige at the end of the series here, when the series started with one of his crewmen being boiled alive by this guy and his nephew peeing on John, kicking him in the dirt, you know, and now he's aligned with that family. Of all the people that he could have been aligned with in all of Japan, here he is aboard this guy's ship, yeah, working with him. That's, yeah, that's a really interesting twist in the long tail of John Blackthorne in Japan.
No, absolutely, absolutely. And I think, it's a really interesting twist going into that last episode.
Mm-hmm.
But speaking of last, let us get to our last Bushido number 5.
Yes, meanwhile in Osaka.
Yes, I mean, we've already discussed about, you know, word reaching Lady Oshiba and Ishido about Toranaga's surrender,
yes,
and effectively, you know, in at least Ishido's mind, his capitulation.
Mm-hmm.
But here, that, you know, there are a number of other things that happen over this episode, which possibly has a bearing on how strong this alliance between Lady Oshiba and Ishido is, and possibly the amount of influence that Mariko may have on Lady Oshiba. Because we see the Daeun, the Lady Daeun, dying from a stroke, but before she passes away, she warns Lady Oshiba of allying with Ishido, and that he came from nothing and is effectively a man of nothing, and that they've picked the wrong side to some extent here. And this is after Ishido proposing to strengthen this alliance that they have through marriage, effectively, between the two of them. And she doesn't answer him immediately anyway.
Well, there's more to it,
earlier on.
Yeah,
but he just says, I will leave that with you to think about.
I think he gets the reaction that he didn't want, because he's saying to her, not only is he saying to strengthen it to the world, is more his proposal, he's saying to strengthen it to the rest of Japan, if we get married, then they'll understand that our goals are aligned, effectively. But he's also saying, I've always looked at you and looked upon you and loved you since the moment I first saw you when you were brought in as the bearer of the heir to the throne. I've always wanted to be with you. And when he gets the reaction that he gets from Oshiba, it really looks like, no, I'm here to get revenge. That's why I'm here. I'm not here to join you, Ishido, in your plan. I'm here to get revenge. I'm not even thinking about my future relationship or anything like that. And interestingly, as the Daeun is dying, she's not only telling her they may have aligned to the wrong people, but she's saying, let the prisoners go, Lady Oshiba. You need to do something about this. The people that you've put in prison here in Osaka, do you not see how bad that is? You know,
absolutely.
You know, your son is going to become the heir to the throne, and this is what you're going to, this is the legacy you're going to leave him with.
And the time that we saw Toranaga in Osaka, he very much was friendly, respectful to the Lady Daeun, you know, who was the wife of the Taiko.
Yes.
So, like, it's really kind of interesting, like, development. Okay, it kind of hangs in the air, really. There's no resolution here, but it's kind of interesting sort of plot lines just hanging there, waiting for it to resolve later on. But you can see that it poses more quandary for Lady Oshiba than it does necessarily convince her to do something about it.
Well, I think what I do like about both scenes is exactly as you say. Both scenes are questions to Lady Oshiba, and both go unanswered.
Exactly.
Both of them are met with silence. In a way, almost, you know, Lady Oshiba, as we mentioned earlier on in the season, when she arrived, the big villain of the series, almost, she is the other side to Toranaga. She's exactly the same as him in some ways. She's considering all the possibilities, considering all the outcomes. She's not a rash person. She's not going to be giving her answer to anybody just because they're telling her what she should be doing. She's going to be considering it. And us as the audience, or me as a member of the audience watching her, I'm going, I don't know which way she's going to go here. I have no idea whether she is going to make this decision of marriage, and the series ends with her as the leader of Japan with Ishido at her side, or will she go a completely different way? Yeah. Will she take the advice of the Daeun, stop everything, walk away from Ishido? You know, I absolutely don't know. And that's what I think is really interesting about both of those scenes and the character herself. I think it's really, really interesting to watch.
Yeah, definitely. I think we've come to the end of our top five Bushidos. Mm-hmm. Any more notes, Derek, on this episode?
Only just one thing that I forgot about why John Blackthorne is choosing Yabushiga to be the one to align with, just because I thought it was quite important. John says he knows he doesn't belong in Japan, but that's kind of where fate's put him, and he needs to make something out of his fate now that that's what's left to him. And from seeing Yabushige fall and be willing to commit seppuku back in the first time he met him, he realizes Yabushige is also someone that follows his fate and will be willing to do whatever it takes to realize his fate. So that's John's proposal to Yabushige to join up with him. So that was, again, interesting on their arc of a story.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And also to that point, I think that initial encounter between John Blackthorne, you know, looking to serve Yabushige on the ship. But it's really good because effectively you can see Yabushige contemplating it, probably wanting to accept it, but refuses it because Mariko is essentially saying it's treachery that is being proposed to you. And Omi equally is looking at his uncle in terms of what his answer may be. So he does refuse it. And I think there's even one point where Mariko says, do you want me to translate that to Yabushige? And she doesn't give Yabushige the exact response of John Blackthorne. I kind of really, really enjoyed that translation sort of scene there where John Blackthorne is effectively looking to bail. Well, no, he has been made a free agent, so he is looking to see where he can go, but his reasoning is that Toranaga has led them down to a cul-de-sac.
Mm-hmm.
At the very end of the previous episode, he says, you're all going to die.
Yes.
So he sees that it's almost a hopeless situation for this clan, this army, these generals or vassals, you know?
Yeah, and I do wonder whether Yabushige is wondering whether this is another test from Toranaga. Given everything he's gone throughout the season, he's kind of going, did Toranaga send John Blackthorne to test my loyalty with me as well, with Mariko right by his side, who Mariko is still very close to Toranaga, as we've seen, you know, the two of them sitting in the room asking Yabushige, where does his allegiance lie? You know, the proposal from John is that as soon as Toranaga is dead, because he's definitely going to die, as soon as he's dead, I want to be Bannerman for you. I want to be on your side. I want to be working with you. And Yabushige responding with, well, that's not going to happen. Toranaga's going to win this whatever way it works. I'm still loyal to my lord. So I do wonder if it was going through his mind and all the possibilities that were there. Maybe this is a test from Toranaga for me and my loyalty once again.
Yeah. But he understands what it would mean for him to say, yes, you can, I think.
Yeah.
And I think certainly from the reaction that Mariko is effectively saying to John Blackthorne and to Yabushige as well.
Yeah.
So yeah, I just really like that scene.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, overall, John, we've got to the end of chapter 8 of Shogun. What did you think overall of the episode? Any final thoughts?
I absolutely love this episode. I just give 5 plans out of 5.
Nice.
I just really like how this all kind of feels like it's fitted together through, whether it's a long-term strategy or plan, whether it's tactical, whether it's just taking the opportunity as it arises. I love this kind of master of Lord Toranaga, you know, whether it is through all these different tricks and techniques that he is using. It almost feels, you know, that this is the Japanese version of Machiavelli, you know, from Italy. And I really, really am enjoying it. And it just feels like it all feels so very kind of consistent, even though I would say half the conversations that lead you to that point, like, for example, you know that Hiramatsu and Toranaga had a conversation to come up with that spectacle at his palace in front of his generals, in front of his trusted advisors. You know they've had that conversation, but the fact that it's not shown, so it comes as a shock. So yeah. Great storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
I just love the whole sort of scale of this. It's really good. And I also just thought it's kind of neat being in Edo, which ultimately is Tokyo. It's so this is where the capital becomes. And that's the other thing that's constantly in my sort of in my mind mm-hmm. is just that, you know, Torunaga's seat of power is effectively what becomes the capital of Japan.
Absolutely.
So, yeah. You know, whatever he does here lays the foundation, in terms of these, plans, mm-hmm. machinations, strategy,
yeah.
Even that whole thing, you know, it's not about my clan. It's not about this clan. It's about Japan. Well, absolutely yeah. loved it. Yeah. Five. Plans out of five.
Great plans. Yes, meticulously planned plans.
Yeah, potentially. Exactly.
Because I do wonder, you know, if the plan itself, just quickly to talk about that, because I loved the episode as well, and I'm constantly thinking about things that happened in it. I'm wondering if his plan was set in motion with him saying, I'm going to surrender. And in his mind, he was going to take whatever chance he's going to take in next week's episode with Mariko. That was his plan. Then his son died, and now he's been able to build on that plan, let's say, to expand upon it. Now he's been able to make sure that Asaka know he's at his weakest point, make
exactly.
sure he's lost his greatest allies, all of those extras that he's
son.
Been able to
He's
add.
Lost his greatest yeah. ally. There's discord amongst mm-hmm. all his key generals.
Yeah.
And he's surrounded by his half-brother's army waiting to bring him
yeah.
back. It's smoke and mirrors. It's theatre mm-hmm. that he's providing for them. And I love that Lady Ashiba is still not convinced until she's got his face pressed
exactly.
in supplication. You know, so I yeah. really, really am enjoying this.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But I do wonder if the original plan of surrender before any of this happened, that was still the cogs were working in his mind that I will say I'm surrendering, but I'm not really going to surrender in the future. I have some plan there, but it's now been expanded upon quite considerably because of his son's death.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And as he said, you've bought me time.
Exactly.
You've
exactly.
earned me time.
Yeah.
Speaking
of time, I think it's time to get some of our feedback from our fellow warriors about Chapter 7, last week's episode. So cast your mind back in time.
Yes. First up, we have an email from Hatamoto Von Doom.
Uh-huh.
Yo, warriors, just a couple of random thoughts. Toranaga's description of his brother was right on point. What a jerk.
Mm.
Nagakado once again exercised poor judgment. What a sad way to die.
Mm.
He should have enlisted Buntara against Sakai.
Mm.
How is a mortician to make a living with all these heads being lost? I'm surprised John Blackthorne keeps his head after tossing insults to the vassals. Sayonara, Hatamoto Von Doom. Well, absolutely. That challenge at the end of episode 7 from John Blackthorne is literally that.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess their predicament with Torunaga's half-brother sort of and his forces assembled in front of them, it may be just not the right time or place, but
yes.
ultimately it is a direct challenge and an insulting or disrespectful challenge
mm-hmm.
to the vassals of Lord Torunaga. So, yeah, interesting.
But again, I wonder, did Torunaga take the opportunistic move there and just cut John Blackthorne loose because John Blackthorne is the unknown quantity that Torunaga has on his side? Asaka may fear what John Blackthorne's been teaching Torunaga and his forces about
yeah.
About Western ways. So now he's cut him free, he's kicked him out, he's sent him to the curb, and there's a reason for it because he was so insulting
yeah.
to them. So if the story gets back to them, there's a story there for John Blackthorne as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Great stuff.
Another layer of the cake, yeah.
Exactly. Thanks so much, Hatamoto Von Doom.
Yes, thanks so much, Hatamoto Von Doom.
We also got an email in from Lisa who says, Hi, Derek and John. Thanks for the wonderful discussion of Shogun. I am a new listener of your show and happy to have found such a thoughtful podcast. Okay, let's be clear. Buntaro does not love Mariko. He is the classic abuser, a cowardly weak man who seeks to feel important by destroying his partner. He knew that she was marrying beneath her station. As she pointed out, he saw her practicing her samurai skills and knew she was more than worthy and that he was unworthy. He said to Taranaga that he thought she would be grateful when he saved her from death and has been waiting for her to be grateful. He can only feel manly when his partners are broken. He keeps her around, hoping that he can break her and because it allows him to use his power over her. But as she pointed out to Blackthorn, she won't give him anything. What he feels is not love. It is also not about seeing her greater purpose for the cause and wanting her to live. He wants to kill Blackthorn because he is now being forced to see that she will never feel for him what he has been trying to make her feel for, but he has convinced himself it is her problem and not his. He now sees that she is in fact capable, which only reinforces that it is he who is unworthy and unmanly. Thoughts? Thanks, Lisa. That's excellently put, Lisa. I couldn't have said it better and didn't say it better when I was talking about it earlier on. But that's absolutely who Buntaro is. He is that classic abuser who believes what he wants he should be getting. He wants her to love him. He doesn't really love her. He doesn't even know what it is. And in this episode, I think we get a great moment from Mariko in chapter 8. We get that great moment from Mariko where she reveals to him, I've never loved you. Don't know what you're talking about. I'd rather live forever than die with you. And again, he's trying to grant her what she's wanted from him, which is death, but for his reasons. So it can be a protest against Lord Taranaga, not because she wants death. He's finally granting it. He wants to do it
even,
as a protest.
Even his father sees that as well and denies him the chance to follow his father in seppuku.
Exactly. Brilliant, Lisa. Thanks so much. Great to hear you're a new listener of TV Podcast Industries.
Absolutely.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Lisa, for the feedback. Really, really great.
Yeah.
On Facebook, Jamie Lawson says, being a player of Total War Shogun 2, I was quite pleased to see that Ishido's ships were familiar to me.
Oh, very good. So another massive detail again.
Yeah.
The detail in the show is incredible. I was watching a video about the actual tea ceremony from the person who taught them how to do the tea ceremony in this episode of the show.
Yeah.
And they were saying that tea ceremonies can last between 40 minutes to 4 hours, depending. And the whole purpose of it is to ensure you show trust between the two people. It's something that you do because everybody's involved, that you're working together. It's a really important service. And that's the kind of level of authenticity they brought to the show. So interesting that the same ships that were used in a video game, Total War Shogun 2, are also being brought into the into the show here, so you recognize them from there. Very cool, Jamie.
Absolutely. Thanks, Jamie. Also on Facebook, Dr. Bob Phillips says, why shouldn't time be measured in alternative units? I found myself asking as this episode started. For example, Daleks mentioned time in Rels, and Napoleon did something unspeakable with clocks, didn't he? Why not have a show that lasts 1.4 candle inches? Oh my God, what the hell is his brother doing? Essentially, this episode had me mildly watching to full energy absorption in a heartbeat. Have we knocked over Taranaga's piece in defeat? Did Blackthorn really huff off, or is it an engine cunning ruse? How traumatic is that childhood? Is this the first authorized red light district? This is why ponds need covers or close adult supervision, because children can die in them. Why is there only one episode left? Well, Dr. Bob, it will be very good for you to hear that there is another 3 episodes to go.
Well,
including this one, episode 8.
Exactly.
And another 2 more remaining.
Yep, 10 episode series, the perfect count for a TV show.
2.8 candle inches left to go after episode 8.
Yeah.
I
love this running commentary from Dr. Bob. It does feel like he's watching and reacting to what's happening on the screen at exactly the same time. I love when I got to Dr. Bob talking about the time being measured in units and then suddenly going, what the hell is his brother doing?
Because
that's what it feels like sometimes. Pay attention to this show or it will come and bite you or shake you and wake you up very quickly, won't it?
Well, that's true. And I mean, whether it is the Taranaga piece on the chessboard that has been knocked over in Surrender, or whether it is a ruse, maybe the ruse includes old John Blackthorn having his little huff and puff and throwing a little hissy fit.
Maybe. I'm not sure whether he trusts John that much.
No, I don't think he does.
Yeah,
no.
Especially just that comment that he made in this episode of they do exactly what you expect them to do, those two, Yabushiga and yeah. John. They may think they're really smart, but they do exactly what you expect them to do.
Well, that's it. I think the engine is a distraction for mm-hmm. people.
Yep.
It allows an element of distraction.
Yes.
You know, why is this guy in his court? Why has he been given Hatamoto? Mm-hmm. Why has he been given these honors? I mean, we've heard it from Omi. So,
yes.
You know, I think there's a distraction element here to why he's brought on board, not just getting tactics, you know? So interesting.
And Dr. Bob, I do want to know what it was that Napoleon did with clocks. Is it something like he created the 10-day working week?
I have no idea.
I feel like it's that's something in the back of my mind.
I've just got Cartman from South Park in my mind at this moment.
Okay.
But I don't know.
I don't know why. But anyway, thanks so much, Dr. Bob. We have got some comments over on YouTube. First up, Sarah says, oh my God, this podcast about Shogun just appeared on my recommendations and I heard an Irish accent. As an Irish girl adoring this show, it's amazing that YouTube finally shows me things I want. fantastic, Sarah. I hope you're enjoying the podcast as well. Actually, I meant to mention Google Podcasts is shutting down, so we're moving all of our podcasts from Google Podcasts over to YouTube at the moment. So they are all audio podcasts, of course, just like all of our podcasts, but you should be able to get most of them now over on YouTube. And a good function of that, especially if you can't understand my Irish accent occasionally, is that there are, of course, subtitles on our YouTube videos, so you can watch along with the subtitles. Hopefully the subtitles are translated correctly from our accents. but they are there, so hopefully that'll help in our understanding. If there's words that we're pronouncing incorrectly, it will still be spelt incorrectly in the subtitles, though.
Yeah, excellent. Welcome on board, Sarah.
Absolutely. Thanks, Sarah. David says, I haven't read the book, so I don't know what will happen next, but my guess is that Toranaga and his half-brother Sakai have a secret plot to double-cross Shido. Toranaga is pretending to surrender to his half-brother and allow him to be escorted back to Osaka Castle. This way, Toranaga is able to avoid the very dangerous task of trying to fight his way to Osaka with a smaller army against a larger foe. Once at Osaka Castle, Sakai will reveal the double-cross and side with Toranaga with his full army at the gates of Osaka. That's my current theory, so it's actually providence that causes Toranaga's son's foot to slip and saves Sakai from being killed by the son who doesn't know the plan and was trying to murder Sakai. What do others think of my idea?
Well, David, I think that is a fantastic idea and theory,
That's cool, to be honest.
Yeah, I think it's really good. And actually, you just wouldn't put it past Toranaga doing that. And who knows, maybe there is something in that to come. I mean, it feels less so from episode 8.
Mm.
It feels like it's much more contained. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, I think that's it's like the Trojan horse approach, effectively, but less hidden, I guess.
Well, yeah. Yeah.
But actually hidden under the guise, the Trojan horse of surrender, you know?
Basically, yes.
So I really, really like that idea.
Yeah. That's great, David. Thanks for that.
Thank you so much, David, for that wonderful theory.
Yeah, it's really cool.
And finally, we have John in Osaka who says, Buntaro actually loves Mariko, but he is too emotionally immature to deal with her lack of love for him. I think there's probably, you know, a good amount of truth in that as well. Mm. I think, you know, I know it's almost cliche to say, but in his own weird way, he probably does.
He thinks he does.
Or he thinks he does, exactly. It is that immaturity.
Mm.
And I think whilst there is probably great intimacy and so on around the tea ceremony and how you project feelings through that or, you know, that, as you say, team, you know, working together to make this cup of tea, I guess from a modern perspective, it's that emotional detachment of showing it through that seems strange.
Exactly.
But that's maybe what they did more. So it's that emotional detachment still. It's formalizing it through the tea ceremony.
Yeah.
But there's not the intimacy or that, in a sense, Mariko has experienced with John Blackthorne.
Yes. There's also so little behind the tea ceremony from Buntaro. He's not calling on.
No.
Do you remember that date? Remember that time I don't know, brought you chocolates and brought you out to dinner and brought you to your favorite play? You know, there's none of that stuff behind
it. Well, remember that time I got absolutely drunk with an engine and then fired arrows past your face?
Exactly.
Can you imagine?
Yeah, he has nothing to show here. He's saying to her, remember that time when we met first when we were so in love? And she's going, I don't remember that. That didn't exist. You're building it up in your mind. And I think, you know, to go back to the point made earlier on of the classic abuser, we often are told that he does love her in his own way. We're often told,
cliche.
That idea that someone that would actually hit their partner, beat them for doing things that had nothing to do with them, would beat anybody for doing things that had nothing to do with them, but would beat the person they're supposed to love, that they do love them in their own way and should stick with them. He's okay. That was just a bad moment. You know, this moment here in this episode proves to me Bontara has no idea what love is and is trying to use those classic trappings to convince Mariko that he does love her when actually there's nothing there behind it.
Nothing there. I completely agree. And that's why I say it's a cliche thing from his perspective.
Exactly. Exactly.
He thinks he does in the way he does it.
Yeah.
And it's not at all.
That's not love.
No.
No.
Excellent stuff. Thanks, John, for the feedback. And thank you to all our fellow warriors for your thoughts, theories on episode 7 of Shogun. Can't wait to hear what you thought of this episode, episode 8.
Yes, absolutely. Thanks so much for all of your feedback. And thanks so much for joining us for this podcast about Shogun. It's been great having all the new listeners that are listening to us just for Shogun on our 10th anniversary year. Bringing in brand new listeners is always good fun. So I'm really enjoying the show and looking forward to the last two chapters of Shogun.
Yes, for sure. Cannot wait to see how this unfolds. Remember, fellow warriors, that we will be back next Wednesday with our chat all about Shogun Chapter 9, Crimson Sky. Yes.
The Crimson Sky finally comes to pass.
It does. Maybe. For a brief moment, I thought I had said Crimson Tide in this episode.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Isn't that the Tom Clancy novel?
I think so.
Yeah, I think that's
or Crimson something Tide. Like that. Yeah. I don't know.
Well, that's Red October. That's completely different.
It's late. I'm starting to fade.
I totally understand. Totally understand. On that note, thank you so much for joining us. We'll speak to you again next time.
Yeah, thank you so much, fellow warriors. Until Chapter 9 of Shogun. Remember, keep watching and keep listening.
Bye.
Bye.